Hello, I'm Mike McCarthy. Officially Michael McCarthy, because my mother would not be happy with me being called Mike, but I seem to have been called Mike all the time I've been in television. I am what is called a sound supervisor, a sound director, sound designer, if one was being pretentious. And I started work with David on the third series of Dad's Army, I think. There was a very, very good young sound mixer who worked with him for the first two episodes, James Cole, who decided to leave sort of the operational side of television and go into management. And so for series three, I was put on the program by our management. I mean, the system was, particularly in those days, that there was a sound manager who allocated people to all the various programs that needed sound mixers. I'd only been mixing probably a couple of years at that stage, and having been told that I was going to do David Croft's Dad's Army, a lot of folks, David's very particular. Be interesting to see how you get on. Because he's had James for previous programs and for the first two series of Dad's Army. It'll be an interesting exercise for you. So I did the first episode of series three, and I did the second episode of series three, and I did the third episode of series three, and the fourth episode of series three. And the production manager put his head in at the end of the show. And I said, just out of interest, is David happy? You know, because I know he knows exactly what he wants. And the reply was, well, if he wasn't happy, he wouldn't be here. So evidently he was happy. I mean, David, I mean, as so many people have said, I mean, he was a perfect gentleman. He wasn't demonstrative. He would put his head in at the end of a day's recording, put his head in the, because I sat in a separate room, the sound room, put his head in the door at the end and say, oh, yes, thank you very much, Michael. And that was that. And it was such a joy working with him that it was slightly unnerving to start with, but then for years and years and years we worked together, so I must have kept doing things the way he wanted to. Being so organised, he followed what was the rule of the day, really, of how situation comedy shows were produced. From my point of view, and from the lighting man's point of view, from the costume people's point of view, and the designer's point of view, each episode, we would meet up perhaps on the Monday morning, and David would take us through the script and saying, this is what we require, this is what we're going to do. I mean, in terms of the designer, I mean, he may well have spoken to the designer a little bit earlier to give him time to construct the things, but the planning meeting was where everybody was told what the program was, or what the aim of the program was, and this went for any sort of program, whether it was comedy or not. And so we could come away from that meeting and start thinking from our own perspective, I say, whether you were the lighting man, whether you were the sound man, whether you were costume, what you would need to prepare and how you were going to go about it and what style you were going to use, if it was a drama or whether it was a comedy show, because the lighting, the sound will all be different. So having had the planning meeting, David and the cast would go to an outside rehearsal room, which was a room away from the television centre. And in, I think, 1970, the BBC rehearsal block was opened in Acton, which had perhaps seven floors of big spaces where productions could rehearse. Prior to that, rehearsals had always been in church halls, youth clubs, because those were the only space. There was no space at Television Centre for just rehearsing. It was really studios for making productions with cameras, with sound, with lighting, but nowhere for artists to rehearse. So we would, David would rehearse on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday with the cast. The room would be laid out with tape on the floor, marking out where the scenery were. Was where the walls were, where a table was, where chairs were. And so they would walk about in a totally empty space. I mean, apart from perhaps if they had to sit on a chair a chair was put there for them to sit on. And so they would learn where they would need to stand within that space, together with learning their lines and their movements. Then on Wednesday morning, all the technical people would arrive. Again, costume, makeup, design. And the cast would run through as far as the piece. It wouldn't be at that stage perfect from their point of view, but it would be a rehearsed 30 minutes of program. And they would perform in this empty space, trying not to walk over line so they weren't going into other sets by mistake, which would then give the lighting designer an idea of exactly where people would stand. So he would organize that if they went to the top left-hand corner, there will be a light to light them there. If they came downstage, there will be a light to light them there. I would work out whether I needed, sound was picked up on booms, I mean, microphones on long arms, which was the convention. And so I'd work out whether I need one boom, two booms, three booms. And so we would all just concentrate on what was needed from our point of view. I'd probably been mixing situation comedies for a couple of years before I started with David. Oh Brother and The Rag Trade and Steptoe and things like that. And the very first outside rehearsal that I went to, I was very aware that all the technical people were standing with sheets of paper and their pens and plans of the layout of the studio, and the artists were performing and nobody was really laughing. I mean, there was funny material, but I mean, rightly, people were very concentrating on working out their part in the program. And I thought, well, no, this isn't right. These actors have been rehearsing now for 3 days. This is the first performance they're giving to outsiders. And we're all just standing, watching and making notes. It must be so heartbreaking that you, particularly you've got funny material and there's nothing coming back. So I thought, I really ought to laugh. And slowly other people joined in until we did get to the stage that it was quite free, that everybody did laugh. And it gave so much encouragement to the cast, because nobody really knows whether something is funny until an audience laugh at it. And I think that's probably why I kept doing comedy shows, because I turned up at the rehearsals and laughed. So people were quite happy to have me there. But so having looked at the rehearsal, there'd be a sort of chat beforehand, and it depended on the production whether we chatted with the cast. I mean, if there were things that we needed to chat to them about specifically, yes, that was fine. But particularly with Dad's Army in the early days, I always felt it was very hierarchical, whatever the word is, that from Mannering downwards, everybody had their position. And I mean, nobody was at all standoffish or unfriendly, but there was always a feeling that you respect, as one should. I mean, you respected everybody, but there wasn't a lot of general conversation with the cast at that stage. And because we didn't really know each other particularly, it was much more of a sort of professional relationship. So having gone to the rehearsal, I would go away, everybody else would go away, sort out all the equipment they need, all the staff they would need. And we would meet in the studio on Friday, because David tended to record on a Friday. And everybody, the scenery would be put in overnight with the lighting rig, and then the lighting director would come in and start setting his lights early in the morning. My crew would come and rig all the microphones, the loudspeakers, and also the microphones and loudspeakers for the audience, because, as you know, we always had a real audience. And this was the joy of situation comedies, and any comedy show, is that you have real people coming in to enjoy the show. My job was to try and capture their enjoyment, to add it to the dialogue that was happening from the actors, so that the viewer at home would feel as though they were in the audience enjoying the program. And it was almost run like a theatre show, that we would, in the morning, go through and the director would talk to camera one and say, this is your first shot. And then he talked to camera two, and this is your first shot, blah, 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 and worked right through the script so that everybody, all the cameramen, knew what their shots were, and the artists would move out. My team would know where they were going to move to in terms of sound, and similarly the lighting man would see that everybody was where he was expecting. So up to about 3 o'clock, it was a very slow, almost line by line rehearsal. After, David was always very keen on having a cup of tea, so we had a cup of tea probably at about 3:30, and at 4 o'clock we would run through the whole piece as live. Of course, occasionally if an artist appeared in the hall of in the church hall and then had to appear in another set, because there would be a break while they moved and the cameras moved, but to all intents and purposes it was run as a live show. After that, everybody would gather together and discuss any problems, blah, blah, blah. And we were then ready, really, to do a theatre show in the evening. It was almost a theatre show that was being recorded with television cameras. And particularly with David, for years and years, we had the wonderful Felix doing the warm-up. And it's such a difficult job being the warm-up man. You really don't know who has come into the studio. They have probably been queuing up in the rain. They'll probably be freezing cold, and probably by the time they get in, they're probably pretty fed up. But the warm-up man has got to, I should say warm-up artist, I suppose, has got to bring those people together so that they're all happy with each other, they're happy laughing out loud, and so that they get to a stage where they're really ready to enjoy the show. Because certainly for most of David's series, it was before any post-production sound was done, there was no dubbing. The laughs we hear on Dad's Army were the laughs from the people in the audience. They weren't added afterwards. And a question I sometimes have from people is, well, how is it there are people, we can hear people laughing when they're going across the forests of Suffolk, following the tank or whatever. But that piece of exterior filming was shown to the audience in the studio in its right sequence. And so hopefully the audience would laugh at that as much as they would laugh at the actors in front of them. And Felix, who always did a wonderful job, I mean, people, well, and it was such a good show, people always reacted. But what you hear on Dad's Army is very much what happened in the studio. And with all television, it was a team effort from everybody's point of view. I mean, the whole production were a team. We all respected David very much, but in some ways, even if you have a producer and a director you don't respect particularly, everybody on a team in television will always pull very hard to make sure that production works. I mean, personalities, once you're really working, almost go out of the window. You are there to produce the very best, for me, very best sound that could be possible on that program, and the lighting person for the very best lighting. But say with David, it was just such a pleasure anyway. And we just work together, and then the lighting people have their own small team. I have a team, and my sound was only ever as good as the sound that the boom operators captured for me on the sets. They had to have the microphone in the right position. Artists would be running about. They would be with the artists. We would, one boom doing one person, one doing another. But if a boom mic was in the wrong position, almost whatever I did with the faders wouldn't make it much better. So from a sound team's point of view, we were all in it together. The end result that I happened to mix together was the result of everybody's input. There's also a position which to this day is still called a gram op, which is somebody who plays in the sound effects and the music. And certainly when I was a gram op in the early 60s, you did play off 78 gramophone records. And even now, even things are fully digital and it's played in off computers and blah, blah, blah. The position of that person is still called a gram op. And over the years, I've had outstanding gram ops who can add exactly the right atmosphere and the funny effects, because so often with things like Dad's Army, an effect has to be exaggerated. If somebody breaks a window, almost the real sound of a window breaking is not funny enough. It has to feel real, but it has to have an exaggeration to it. And having people who can find those right sorts of the sounds and explosions or whatever and the right bits of music, you've really got to have the right person with you. And luckily, I mean, all the time I was with the BBC, I had the right person or people. I mean, I only worked with probably two or three different people over all the years I was there, because I'm not with the BBC now because my contract finished in 1961, I suppose, because when you get to 60 years of age, you have to leave. So I'm freelance now, but again, I still work with those same Gramophs and those same people. But we all come together from different directions. It was just such a joy with David's programmes to run the signature tune, go into the first scene, and whoever had the first funny line, to have the audience react in the studio, and I could have I had one fader which was controlling all the audience mics, and I could gather together all their reaction and mix it with the dialogue. Some golden rule, as far as particularly comedy is concerned, though, is that, and I suppose everybody wanted as loud an audience reaction as possible, particularly in David's time, but you must never let the sound of the audience cover the words from the artists, because there's nothing more infuriating at home than not being able to hear the next line because it's covered with laughter, which does mean if you listen to a lot of the Dad's Armies, it sounds almost as though the laughs have been put on afterwards and chopped beginning and end, because my handling of the audience to get the maximum out of it was that I would wait for the funny line to finish so everybody heard it, give an enormous amount of audience, but nip that audience sound back again before the next line comes in, which makes for very clipped laughs. It's almost ha ha, which can sound very much so it's done, but I assure you it was all real. I mean, there are technical reasons also for not having the audience faded up while the artists are speaking, because you are feeding the artist's dialogue to the audience through loudspeakers. If you fade up the audience microphones too early, the artist's voice sounds as though they've disappeared into a cave, because all you're hearing is the echo of the PA in the studio. So, I mean, that's purely a technical point, which also added to the fact that it was so clipped. But there's nothing, and still is, to be honest, nothing more wonderful than doing a show is very well written, as all David's shows were, to have an audience that really appreciates it and finish the evening, that you know you have a programme that was funny, you've captured the sound of the enjoyment, and it is just so pleasing from my point of view. Yes, we did meet them at these outside rehearsals, but not in a sort of social sense. What, having mentioned that the exteriors were shown to the audience, it used to be done by a different department. And then once we got into LOLO, we started going out on location, which was much more where most of the location scenes in Dad's Army were actually shot out in Suffolk, and they were shot on 16mm film. And as a studio sound mixer, I didn't get involved with those because they were done by film department at Ealing. And it was only in later years, particularly perhaps when we were doing LOLO, the early episodes of those, again, the location were filmed outside on 16mm film. And then there was a series of probably 24, 26, I can't remember, LOLOs commissioned for America, which was some short length, about 24 minutes. But so this was a sort of bumper box to do. And David managed to actually have the town square in LOLO built in what used to be an old garage at BBC Elstree Studios. And so for that particular series, and I don't know whether it was broken up into separate series, but it was a long run of things, the exteriors, the town square, were actually done inside in one of our studios. And then when video cameras and sound equipment became lighter, it was particularly the video side where we're trying to take studio cameras outside was ridiculous, whereas film cameras were much more portable. Cameras were available that you could take out and record with standard video. So we started to do location shoots, and we did some on LOLO and Oh Dr. Beeching and You Rang My Lord. I mean, the Dr. Beeching up and down the railway line, which was a whole new world for all of us. I mean, because the studio cameramen went, the sound people went, the lighting people went, and I mean, film department have been making these sort of films for years and years and years. So it was quite a learning experience for us. But we suddenly realized that this was also different in a sort of relationship sense. In the studio, because we, apart from the, if we had done a previous series, when the cast arrived on episode one of a series, they were either all totally new to us or they were the people we'd seen in the last. And everybody chatted and we were polite, but there was no camaraderie as such because we were all there to do a job. And it was all very pleasant. There was sort of no nastiness. But once we got out to do the filming, when you're up at 6 o'clock in the morning, staying in a field of mud, eating a bacon sarnie, and everybody's turning up to get the thing, and then you're working out in the open air and you're working against the elements and staying in the same hotel, we became much more of a complete team. There wasn't a sort of team of technical people who had done the exterior and then team of technical people who did the interiors. We were there inside and out, which, yes, perhaps that did give a different relationship with everybody. Because in the studio, I mean, people got to know everybody's names, but of course we all came back, we knew each other well, and we also knew each other's sort of strangenesses. But no, it was a major change from our point of view. And apart from that, technically, the pictures taken on video on location match the pictures of the studio set so much better. You can always tell when you're outside on Dad's Army because the pictures are sort of a bit fuzzy and grainy because they were made on 16mm film. With Dr. Beeching, when you can have the ticket hall, which was probably shot in the studio, go through to the platform and to the train, it's on a video camera, and the pictures match up. And yes, so having got pictures that matched, it seemed to make the programme much more coherent. And perhaps, in general, folk don't notice on Dad's Army that the picture quality is so different. But of course, when you're trained and you're taught in television, it stands out like a sore thumb. So it was so nice to have this matching. And we had sort of a couple of particularly good lighting designers, and one particularly who started coming out on location, who was so inventive and so quick, because one of the problems with exterior filming is that it often takes a long time to set up the scene, to set up the lights. I'm purposely not mentioning any names because I think if you mention a name and leave somebody out, it's not fair. But this particular friend of mine, I was at school with him, we were getting through so much material outside, which was far quicker than was expected, because he was able to get the scenes lit quickly and we were all able to shoot the scene quickly, and we used more than one camera. The film department, because that was the way things were done, would shoot things with one camera and then they move the camera, whereas we could use two cameras and make things run much more quickly. I mean, it's part of, I mean, both in the studio and outside, part of my responsibilities were, I mean, not only waggling the knobs to make it sound good, was the communications, that everybody could talk to each other, everybody could hear each other, blah, blah, blah. And so when we were on location, David always had a little tent that he sat in, and he would have a television monitor, and we would supply him with headphones, and he would listen. And I think, probably as other people have said, there were never any histrionics from him. We would do a take, and then we'd look towards the tent, and if David was still sitting down quietly with a smile on his face, we knew that was good. If he was standing up, we knew there was something wrong. And it would be discussed and we'd do it again. But there was no need for him to speak, almost, that we could see by whether he was sitting or whether he was standing, whether he needed to do it again. He was so organized, and had a very good team of production managers, because a production manager organizes the whole process in the ergonomics of it. Even though David and whichever co-writer he was with at the time, whether he was with Jimmy or whatever, would never want to shoot things that were impossible. They would seem impossible when you read them in the script, but he would always sort out the positions of the actors and the way it was going to work so that whoever was lighting it could light it, whoever was doing the sound could get the sound. I think it was probably an LOLO. Reading the script, most of the cast are in a cage, basically, which means you can't really get much light at them, and you can't get the booms into them because there's a cage. Now, on first reading, you think, well, how on earth is this going to work? But David, being David, and the directors he worked with, again, all super people, anybody who had a line to say would walk to the front of the cage, and they would be lit. You could see them, and they would also be heard. There was never anybody sitting at the back of the cage saying lines that were of any importance. And it's all these sort of simple things which really made his programs and the whole sequence of his series work properly. A church tower in the studio, and there were people, I mean, it was up on high rostra, and people crawling along flagpoles, and there was a clock and a thing. But again, on reading, you think, well, how on earth is it going to be done? But David would have it in his mind sorted that it could be seen and it could be heard. There was, I mean, not that there were great difficulties in it, but there's one wonderful scene. Now, was this Save My Son? But Pike is stuck out by the sea with barbed wire. He's caught on some barbed wire. And we were in the biggest studio at Television Centre, and the whole of the acting area was the beach, with a beach hut or whatever on one side. But the rest of it was sand, and Pike was at the end. And the whole episode revolved on that. But it all worked as one smooth operation. Again, when you first reading, you think, well, I don't know, how's he going to do it? But that was the joy of working with David. It was his sheer professionalism of knowing it was no good being arty about stuff if it can't be seen and it can't be heard. And his dialogue was the most important thing, and the performance of the actors was the most important thing. So just to get a fancy shot somewhere, again, it wasn't worth doing something silly. The bank where the bomb fell, people in the vault, people upstairs. Again, very nicely thought out, that people on two levels chatting up and down. It was just such a joy, because everybody's different. Different directors bring different things, but occasionally you can work with people. You think, well, it would be nice actually if everybody was 5 feet nearer. You almost could get the same pictures, and it would be so much easier. But everybody does it differently. And I mean, saying that, I mean, there is so much super stuff being shot these days under very different conditions. And I'm full of admiration for things that people do now. It's television progresses, and that's what we did at the time. Yes, just thinking of the various series that David had, there's one that doesn't get repeats. Ain't Half Hot Mum. Again, totally different. And it always, again, because we had the same very, very good lighting director, it always looked and felt hot and sticky. There was the right atmosphere. But again, approached in exactly the same professional way that David would. I mean, the other thing, from my point of view, that one would get involved in is recording the signature tunes for the various series. I didn't do the Dad's Army one, because that was done before I started doing the series, but Hello, Hello, and Lang White Order is all part of that. The signature tune for It Ain't Half Hot Mum was actually recorded in the studio. Sadly, I forget the name of the character who played the piano, but he played the piano, and the cast gathered round, and they all sang their signature tune. And there was a lovely shut-up at the end. You know, that was actually done in the studio just as a live piece on the very first episode, and it stayed with us ever since. Yes, over the years, I've decided that I couldn't be the person who all production companies have, who is able to read through a script that comes in and decide whether this would make a good series. Because I must admit, when I don't think I'd actually seen the first two series of Dad's Army when I started, and I had the script for series 3, episode 1, sent to me to read before we had our planning meeting, and I couldn't see much humour in it. It was fine. I mean, it was just the thing. And it's only when the producer and the director and the artist come together and put their stamp on each character that you suddenly see the potential, and you see what the writer had seen when he wrote those lines. Because something that looks quite pedestrian on the page suddenly comes to life. So I could never be one of those people who reads scripts and decides whether they're fine. And the same thing for It Ain't Half Hot Mum. Again, I read it through, and I thought, yeah, that's right. But it was Jimmy's memories, I believe it was Jimmy's memories, of the Army Entertainment Corps, that he could bring all that life and suggest it to the artists, and it became a concert party. And then you suddenly say, oh, these are why these lines work. These are the relationships between the people. I mean, television has always been a mystery to me, really. I come along and try and make something that sounds as good as possible that relates to that particular program. But no, I certainly couldn't tell you whether it's funny before we started. I mean, as it to do with nothing at all. Going back on the very coarse sort of laughter that was very fashionable and that I seemed to be able to do, one of my sons was in hospital doing one of the series of Dad's Army, and I went to visit him one evening, and there was a Dad's Army on the television in the children's ward, and it was one of the small televisions that always sounded quite tinny anyway, but almost you could go into the entrance of that hospital, and all I could hear was, I could hardly hear any dialogue, but this terribly shrill laughter coming out of this place. And you suddenly get to think, oh, I did that. I mean, that's, but it really was a horrid noise. Now, my mother, who unfortunately began to lose her hearing in later years, became very adept at turning down the laughter. Because her hearing was not good, she would have the television up very, very loud. But of course, then with this very shrill laughter, that became quite hard for her. And I remember we had done a show the previous week, and I went to visit her, and she was watching it. And she was managing, using the remote control, because remote controls must have come back then, to mute every laugh. She didn't miss any dialogue, but she took out every laugh that I'd work my socks off to capture. But she was just, and all that was left was all the dialogue. I mean, she thoroughly enjoyed it, but how are you doing that? I mean, that's, perhaps she should have been a sound mixer too. Now, I am amazed how particularly David's series have had such a long life. Going from Dad's Army, which thankfully seems to be on virtually every Saturday, perhaps the secret is, well, yes, they are very, very funny, but also so many of them are timeless. Dad's Army was set in wartime, and it is it captures that mood. Are You Being Served? I mean, the big department store and all the characters there. It Ain't Half What Mum is different. I mean, yes, I know it was a long time ago, and it again was sort of during the war, but there are elements there which perhaps today would not be considered right, particularly if you have actors playing somebody of a different race. I mean, today we would probably make sure we had somebody who was from the race that they were playing. But all the others, You Rang My Lord, again, set in the big house, again, timeless. It would be nice to see some of those again, but they were a difficult length too, because they were 45 or 50 minutes, which is a long slot for a comedy show these days. But say Heidi High, again, I mean, people seem to thoroughly enjoy it, and it does capture the holiday camps of the time. They're just so beautifully done that long may they last, really. Yes, all these different programmes with so many different styles, it's just been so good to work on them all. I wouldn't be able to pick out a favourite series or a favourite episode. You were always dealing with sort of quality material. And I suppose part of the job anyway as a sound supervisor is that you are there to create the very best output for that particular programme. I mean, there were some I remember... everybody being in the water tank when the bank was flooded and these sort of thing. There's not one I could really say, no, that was really my favourite. You Rang My Lord, I have an affection for, because it was a totally studio location, just so we were involved with the whole lot of it. But because in the main, the cast were the same for them all, it was all the same lovely people. The challenges of Dr. Beeching and on the railway and all these things, again, were added bonuses. But I can't really think of any particular favourite series. They were just all wonderful to do. And see, as long as David was at the helm, you knew it was going to work, come hell or high water.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure to do it.